thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 91, recorded on October the 5th, 2012. This is our Black Helicopter edition.
Well, welcome everybody to another edition of Digital Campus. We are broadcasting live from the Black Ops campus. You may hear helicopters buzzing our buildings in the background, and that's not because the New World Order is about to be inaugurated in Fairfax, Virginia, but instead because Barack Obama is speaking on our campus as we speak to you live here on Digital Campus. And of course, given that presidents require a fair amount of security and also news coverage, the helicopters are buzzing us. So if you hear helicopters in the background today, that's why.
Thank goodness they're not coming for us.
Not yet. Of course, if we crack any jokes about terrorism or things like that, they probably will just, you know, get us on a flyby. Fortunately, you know, we, after the presidential debate the other night, as regular listeners to the podcast know, we don't actually have to debate one another or win our debates. We just have to tell you what we think. So in addition to me, Mills Kelly, your host, we have Dan Cohen. Dan, how are you doing today?
Not bad. I feel like this is the second time we've had Obama speaking on campus during a recording of the podcast. Am I wrong about that?
I think you're right. I think we had that a couple of years ago, maybe during the last campaign.
You know, I think you're absolutely right, which shows you just how long we've been at this whole podcasting thing.
Gosh.
I can't make my phone stop ringing.
That's the Black Ops. They're calling you about that.
I know.
That terrorism statement you just made.
See how fast they heard?
Yeah.
As soon as I cracked a joke about terrorism, already they're calling. Well, for listeners today, if you hear my phone ringing, it's because we've gone to voice over IP here at George Mason, and if I disconnect my phone, then I disconnect from the internet as well. Also with us today is Tom Scheinfeld from Baby Central in Connecticut. Tom, how's it going with the new baby?
It's going well. Henry Kirk Scheinfeld, 9 pounds, 5 ounces, was born a couple weeks ago, and we are suitably sleep-deprived, but coming to you, our audience, faithfully, from my baby bunker.
Well, if you hear any squalling in the background, we'll understand if you have to step off the podcast.
You may. So, beware.
Hey, okay. Tom, I think some regular listeners probably have the itch to know, is the Kirk from James Tiberius Kirk of the USS Enterprise?
I would like it to be, but no, it's a family name from my wife's family.
Great.
Well, I will say that one of the people who works for me, her new baby, his middle name is Tiberius for that exact reason.
Oh, gosh, brilliant.
Very cool.
Yeah. So, you know, Star Trek will live on for another few generations. So, talking about futuristic technology, one of the big stories since our last podcast is the debut of the iPhone 5. And I will say I thought about it because my contract with our friends at Verizon is coming to a conclusion in a few days. And I thought, what a perfect opportunity to go and look at the new iPhone 5. And I went, I looked, I decided no, for one very simple reason, and that is it's too big. I think my iPhone is too big, and so the iPhone 5 is just slightly bigger, and I just decided I don't like that.
Wow, so you must not be a fan of the Samsung Galaxy Elephant 5X.
The mini laptop in your pocket? Yeah, that was another one I'm just not going for. So I think I'm going to have to snap up another iPhone 4 while it's still possible. Either of you guys looked at the iPhone 5?
Yes, I have one. And according to maps, I'm actually broadcasting from Fairfaxia in Siberia, Russia.
Ah, very good. So I was wondering
might be why my Skype connection is not very good today.
Yeah, or why it seems a little chilly outside.
Yeah, I got to say, you know, I mean, I like it. I'm a slave to Steve Jobs' vision. It's a nice looking object. The big screen is, you know, slightly nicer, but I don't have enormous prehensile thumbs, and so I am finding that, you know, it's not it. I know they've got these like ads out about it's like the phone there. You can still get your thumb from corner to corner, but I actually end up hitting like the trash button with the bottom of my thumb when I try to reach the top of this. So I have no, how do people with these giant Android phones do anything? I don't really get it.
I think two hands, really.
Two hands, yeah. How are you supposed to drive then?
right. This is my question.
I actually found those ads really kind of interesting in that I think they were, it was sort of telling to me that was the feature they were really, that they're really pushing. And it seemed a little like, so the reason I should buy this phone is that it's a good size. Like, you know, like that just seems like, well, then that positions the iPhone just as sort of like yet another phone in the marketplace where there's phones as small as 3 inches and as big as 5 inches. And, you know, you can kind of have your pick, but it seemed like, you know, usually like, in the Steve Jobs era, there was some new, amazing, life-altering feature. Like, this changes the game. This changes the state of the art of technology. You know, here it is, Siri, or here it is, you know, iTunes, or, you know, some big thing. And this is like, yeah, it's a phone that's kind of a medium-sized phone in the smartphone universe. Oh, okay, well, that's it? That was my overall reaction to it. Now everybody's going to say, "Oh, there Tom goes again, an iPhone hater." But I do think this was definitely kind of just an evolutionary step, and it seems to me that this is sort of the second evolutionary step that Apple has taken in the last two product cycles. The 4S seemed pretty derivative and evolutionary to me, and the 5 seems kind of evolutionary and derivative to me. The industrial design, in fact, is exactly the same as it was 3 years ago now. You know, that basically that shape, that form factor is what they've been going with since the iPhone 4. And so I feel like there's a, maybe, I don't know, you know, maybe this is reading tea leaves, but maybe there's sort of a little bit of a lack of creativity in the post Steve Jobs Apple.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really nice phone. If you hold it and fondle it like I'm doing right now, it is, you know, it's a very attractive phone. It is definitely an evolution. Since I haven't been on LTE before, this is the first phone I've had. I know that Android folks have been on LTE for a while. I'm rather shocked by the speed of it. And so the one kind of transformative thing for me, and potentially thinking about, let's say, your average student who might pick up one of these phones, is I could totally see getting rid of an internet connection and just using the hotspot. Although I guess you'd run out of data quickly if you overdid it. But it is definitely faster. The LTE is faster than when I try to like load a web page with my Wi-Fi at home.
Oh yeah. So, yeah, that is,
so I'm, I mean, kind of, although I guess if everybody does that, then it's going to slow down. Right. I don't really get that piece of it, but, for me, that's been the big, change. I still would love like a small phone, you know, like a 2.5 inch phone. Yeah. Why isn't someone going the other direction? I don't really get that.
Well, you know, I was in Europe last week, and a lot of the people in Europe are carrying around really small phones. And
yeah, like Nokia used to make like great, really tiny phones. They were awesome. They were like tiny little candy bars.
Well, and mostly they, you know, mostly they just use them for voice and text, and you know, they're not data phones, and they live on those, and it's, you know, it's fine. I mean, I happen to love my iPhone. I'm very happy that I have it, and I like all the data features, but I could also get by just on voice and text, which, you know, then would be virtually free, because that's, you know, Verizon is now offering the, it's just voice and text are free, and, you know, you have to pay your monthly charge, but you don't have a data, if you didn't have a data plan, it would be pretty inexpensive to have a phone.
Yeah. You know, my sister-in-law, you know, I've had a lot of family up here helping us with the baby. She actually has, which is like nobody else in the planet has, but do you guys remember the Microsoft Kin? So this was a little phone.
Right. They had like a little pebble one, right?
Right. It came out about 3 years ago, and it was like a huge flop in the marketplace. And the line on it was like too little, too late from Microsoft, which, you know, it sort of was. I mean, it was not in any way a competitor to the iPhone or the first really good Android phones that were coming out at the time. But this thing is awesome. It has like probably a 2.5, maybe 3-inch screen. It has a limited selection of apps, really the apps that you need: calendar, Twitter, Facebook, you know, browser, a couple of other apps, like the main ones. It doesn't have like an app store or anything where you can, you know, get really cool, you know, painting apps or anything, but it has like the main things you need. It's got a nice screen. It's pretty quick because the data it's bringing in is pretty simple. And it's a really nice little phone. And I think it's like they just couldn't make it work in the marketplace because the line on it was like, oh, well, it's only got a 3-inch screen compared to this new Android phone, which has a 5-inch screen, or it's only, you know, it only has 15 apps compared to the App Store, which has 100,000 apps, you know. But I do think you're right that minimalist device actually probably has some legs if it could get past the kind of hype cycle.
Yeah, I also have to say that one of the people I was meeting with in Europe, but is an American, he was carrying around, it made me so nostalgic, it was just like my very first cell phone. It was an AT&T phone made by Nokia, and it had the raised buttons. It was sort of narrow and long, and I said, oh, that's just like the phone first cell phone I ever had. And they told me I had to trade it in because it wouldn't work on the network anymore. And he said, yeah, they told me that too, like 7 years ago. So it still seems to work fine. And he was making international calls on his AT&T plan. Of course, he doesn't do anything but calls. But it makes me now wonder about all this obsolescence. You know, it won't work on the network anymore, so you must upgrade. Well, now call me a skeptic. So we'll see, you know, how many of these phones we start seeing. But I do think, you know, in our classes and in our places of employment, I do think, though, there is, you know, talking about the size issue, it's not clear to me this sort of blurring of the line between the phone and the tablet computer. I mean, this Galaxy phone is clearly moving more toward tablet than phone. And so it's going to be interesting to see where it all falls out. I would much rather have something that fits nicely in my pocket, which is why I'm not getting the iPhone 5. Yeah. The next story, big story that we want to take a look at is one we've tracked for a long time on the podcast, and that is the seemingly endless litigation between Google and various copyright holders. And there was a lot of progress for a change in that litigation. Dan, you want to tell us what happened?
I guess the question is it really progress? You know, it's certainly a huge milestone for a 7-year-old lawsuit. I'm always stunned at how long these lawsuits take. But the American Association of Publishers, the AAP, settled yesterday. There's a press release with Google over what originally was the Google Library Project. And interestingly, Google has reverted to calling it that. I think it like sounds better in PR that it's the Google Library Project rather than Google Books, which is now what everyone calls it because it's at books.google.com. There are 20 million plus book scanning project, and they're still going. And of course, most of those books are still in copyright, and so they were sued by the Authors Guild and the AAP. The AAP yesterday settled. Basically, it said, well, times have changed in the last 7 years. There's now actually a mature market for e-readers like the Kindle and the iPad, and Google has scanned in our backlist, effectively, all these old books. And so we've come up with an arrangement whereby if they sell those books that are still in copyright to users, that we'll get a cut of that. So I kind of viewed it, the settlement, as they came up with a revenue sharing deal. I mean, that's basically the bottom line. There have been still no solutions to the actual root legal questions. I think particularly for our audience, the question of fair use and whether Google scanning to make books searchable was an instance of fair use or a rash example of illegal copying, copyright violation, infringement. So I think it's a practical deal. I think they realize that, they can make some money off of their backlist, and Google now has, I think actually relates to our first story about cell phones, cell phones and tablets. Google now actually has a decent market through its Google Play, which is store, which is like the Apple App Store. So they've got a big addressable market of people, tens of millions of people. And so the publisher said, all right, I assume they'll get the majority of any sales through Google Play for some 1975 book that's out of print, and might as well take the money while it's on the table. So they went ahead and settled. And in some ways, I think the settlement doesn't really settle much, particularly from the campus perspective. The really big case for us is what happens with HathiTrust, which is the nonprofit that is storing the kind of aggregate scans from Google at the multiple campuses that are partnering with Google. And, they were sued, University of Michigan and others who were part of the HathiTrust sort of genesis and board. And so I think we're supposed to get a ruling on that actually relatively soon, at least some kind of initial ruling if I read the coverage yesterday. So I think, the big legal questions about fair use are still up in the air, but at least the publishers are out. But if you've been following this case on the podcast, and it's incredible to think that it's 2 years older than this podcast itself and still hasn't been resolved, you probably know that the Authors Guild has been really the kind of vicious, dogged pursuer of Google and the universities, and I don't see them letting up anytime soon in the way that the publishers did yesterday.
Yeah, I would be surprised too. I mean, I think of them sort of as the terrier that has Google by the ankle.
Yeah,
and just won't let go. And it'll be very interesting to sort of see what they do in response to this, whether they just sink their teeth in a little tighter on the ankle or say, well, actually, this might be a way of getting a piece of that financial pie also. I tend to think that they're going to sink their teeth in a little tighter.
Right. I mean, do the authors – here's the question is how many authors really can, from a kind of legal and business perspective, ask for some kind of revenue share? A lot of authors do sign away their copyright to the publisher. I think the publishers now are looking at the landscape, and I think they're pretty excited about it. I mean, between the Kindle and the iPad, all of a sudden people are buying more books. It's midnight. You just finished your Ian Fleming James Bond novel. Ah, the library's closed. Oh, look, it's $9.99 on Google Play or Apple's App Store or the Kindle or whatever. One click, boom, you got it. They're getting money that they wouldn't have gotten. I assume their revenue, their projections for revenues are going up. So I think they like the landscape. And I think when this lawsuit started, I think they didn't like the landscape. And so a lot has really changed.
Well, right. I think when the lawsuit started, they couldn't imagine the future that would become, and now that future is sort of here, and they're seeing that actually this is a pretty good business for us, and so that makes sense for them. It seems to me that the authors, they, without the publishers, they've already sort of sold, they've already hitched their wagon to the publishers when they signed their contract with them back in the night, the author signed the contract with the publisher back in the 1970s or 80s or 90s, whenever it was. And that they're not really going to be able to unhitch that wagon.
Well, and you know, that's really interesting you say that, Tom, because one of the things I've been thinking about with respect to this is that over the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of scholars have been reclaiming, I don't know if it's a lot, but some number of scholars have been reclaiming their copyright on books that they published a decade ago, 2 decades ago, that have, you know, gone out of print, and so they've been reclaiming that copyright and then reissuing some of them those books as ebooks. And that's going to stop right now, because now the publishers have an incentive to hold on to that copyright. Before, a number of university presses have been, to my mind, surprisingly willing to just hand back the copyright to the author and say, you know, we're never going to do anything with that book again. And so, sure, you can have it back, and you want to turn it into an ebook or whatever you want to do, that's fine with us. But they're not going to do that now.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right.
I think that window has closed.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see what the authors do. I mean, you know, the Authors Guild, like, really, what is it? You know, I mean, it's run by a legal thriller writer. It has about 8,000 members. I think part of the big, you know, set of amicus briefs that were submitted to the court effectively said that there are lots of authors, like academic authors, who kind of don't feel they're part of the Authors Guild, that they aren't represented by the Authors Guild. And so, I'm still confused about how this ends without some kind of ruling on the main issues. But it may be that, you know, they also reach some point at which they have diminishing returns on it. And speaking of dogged, I mean, Google and their legal team is dogged, right? I mean,
yeah.
They got plenty of money. They can sit it out. If you read some of the, you know, statements by David Drummond and others in the legal team at Google, I mean, these are relatively smart people working there. So, you know, they've taken every possible tack, including going after the class certification, the court's certification about the Authors Guild actually representing authors. Now, they happened to lose that when Judge Chin said, well, you know, you guys scanned everybody's books, so why can't they say that they represent everyone? But they're gonna approach this from every possible angle and drag it out.
Yeah, so this still falls into the category of stay tuned. But as you say, at least it was a milestone, and in this piece, so one piece of this has been settled. I will say, you know, I got a check in the mail from a class action administrator a couple of weeks ago for the Google Money Tree settlement. And it was like $24.65 or something like that. Who knew I was in that class?
Yeah, right.
So I bought myself a really nice lunch, thanks to whoever those crusading anti-Google people were.
Right.
But so, you know, every once in a while, a little bit of Google trickles down to my house. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't distressed. And so it'll be, you know, I think we'll be talking about this probably for at least another couple of years, unless the Authors Guild decides to get on the same bus with the publishers, which I would be surprised if they do. Another story in terms of milestones that was in the news is that Facebook now has 1 billion users. My question about that is, how many more people on the planet can be connected to Facebook? I mean, how many more people can actually be on the internet? And so, I mean, surely more than a billion, but there's an upper limit there. And are they getting close to it?
You know, I had a piece on a couple of years ago about this was not such a off in the future prediction, but you know, I predicted the rather obvious point that Facebook would have a billion people and sometime in this decade would surpass China as the largest aggregate of humans in history. So I guess this is no surprise. I mean, it is a rather big number, and you know, it's interesting to see the coverage of it. They do make a good point that, you know, there are very, very few corporate entities that reach a billion people. You know, Coca-Cola is one of them, for instance.
McDonald's, maybe.
McDonald's, I think, is the other. And so it's some kind of achievement. And if you read the coverage, the evil genius world dominator, who is the great hooded one, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, did predict that they're going to get a lot more people. there are billions of people left. And one of the ways you're going to do it, actually just circling back to the beginning of the podcast, is through smaller and less able cell phones, right? So most people in the developing world are not going to have a MacBook Air. They're going to have a relatively basic cell phone with a rudimentary screen, probably using something like wireless access protocol, which is a kind of simplified digital transmission protocol. And so they are developing something that is called Facebook Zero, I believe, with a kind of nod to Coke Zero. And that would actually distribute Facebook to those kinds of phones. So, you know, I think they've got serious designs on getting, you know, all living, breathing human beings. And, you know, when you hear things about, I think there was something this week about some government organization in the UK thinking about using Facebook sign-in for their website, which got a lot of, like, outcry. And it's kind of scary to think that it becomes our new Social Security number.
I think Facebook puts itself in kind of a bad position by advertising its how big its network is, because, I mean, there's a difference between Coke and McDonald's having a billion customers and Facebook having a billion customers. And, well, there's a couple differences. The first difference is, you know, when I buy that double cheeseburger off the value menu at McDonald's, I hand over a dollar and I eat that cheeseburger. When I sign up for Facebook, which I have done twice now, so presumably I'm counted as two users, I hand over no money, and I may not use the service, which I don't. On both of those accounts, I don't use the service. So, you know, when they say, well, we've got to, you know, like, it puts them in this category of Coke and McDonald's, but in fact, the business looks nothing like those things. And so the expectations, like, and we saw this in the overvaluation of its IPO, you know, the expectations are that, like, well, this is like McDonald's. And in fact, it's not actually, it's nothing like McDonald's. Like, these are a billion people, but these are a billion people who, most of them who spend no money or who generate no money, no revenue for Facebook. And many, many, many of whom aren't really active on the service. They actually never even walk into the door. So I think, you know, while, you know, I think Facebook has this kind of catch-22 that they're faced with, which is they want to advertise how big and omnipresent the network is. But by doing so, they create some expectations that they really can't live up to. And so they're caught between that.
Well, this someone I met with this past week, who is a venture capitalist in New York, she told me, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but I was really surprised to hear that the Twitter is generating significantly more revenue through its mobile apps than Facebook is, and it was a significant difference only in mobile revenues. But her take on it was that that Facebook really hasn't figured out how to make money off of mobile, and they better do it soon, because this and in relation to the two things we've been talking about, or that Dan mentioned, one is that, you know, if their strategy is built on their expansion strategy is built on more mobile users, but they haven't figured out how to monetize that, that's a problem. And then the second thing is that the bigger they get, the greater the expectation will be that they are going to generate some significant amount of revenue. And so, you know, if you have a billion users, how come you're not generating more revenue? And so that's the other challenge they have to work out, is how they're going to make money on mobile. And apparently they're lagging on that one. And I'm sure they will tell you that they have lots of good ideas that we'll see soon, but I'm going to not hold my breath.
Well, you know, what strikes me is that, you know, the reason it's tough to make money on mobile is that the screen's so small, right? And so display advertising, even text advertising, is hard to squeeze in, annoying, people hate it, the click-through rates are small. And what sort of scares me about the situation you just laid out there, Mills, is that the only obvious other way to make money is from, you know, data mining personal preferences.
Right.
And that's what got me out of Facebook to begin with. And so, not to be sanctimonious about it, but it's just I feel like worried about, you know, the vast majority of people who are still on it, the way that their personal life is going to be mined for greater revenue. Because if you can't do it through display ads or text ads, you have to do it by selling information or by using that information in some way. So
Facebook has shown a willingness to, you know, change the terms of your the privacy terms, the terms of your interaction with the service, you know, at their will and without much notice and without much instruction to the user. So yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I'm going to be really interested to see after this campaign season is over, articles coming from our colleagues in political science about the ways that campaigns have made use of that exact kind of data, because they're so into micro-targeting now. Facebook data has to be a really crucial part of their strategy, because why wouldn't it be? And so I'll be real interested to read some of the analyses of that, and I expect that there'll be a lot of people who are not so happy to know that they were targeted for campaign advertising based on what they liked on Facebook. Related to this privacy concern is that is another story that we've talked about over the last couple of years, is the rapid growth in facial recognition and image recognition technology. And there was a story just this week about Google buying another startup that is engaged in image recognition or facial recognition technology. And Facebook has, you know, big plans on that. And iPhoto for Apple already will sort all your photographs for you based, you know, once it starts figuring out who your children are, then it'll pick them out of all the photographs. This, you know, as image mining continues to get better, it seems to me that this is going to be a real boon for people in the humanities as we start trying to grapple with these giant image databases. What do you guys think?
Well, right. I mean, this is the way that Mark Zuckerberg can figure out where you are and where you've been and all that stuff. You know, it is kind of scary in that it's one of those science fiction technologies that I think we thought wouldn't be around for a long time. It's like auto translation. I think we kind of thought that whole notion of the Babel fish where you'd like speak into your phone and then it would come out in French. You know, I think we thought that was like decades in the future. And then just from like the scale of data and some advances that have been made in computer science over the last decade, and the processing power and the scale that, you know, a billion users gives you and hundreds of thousands of servers give you, I think it's like here faster than we're ready for it. And, you know, so I think it freaks people out when they realize that, you know, there are cameras, you know, looking at your faces when you're going into the baseball stadium. And that can pull out, you know, people that they're looking for. You know, that being used on for kind of non-crime bases is, you know, obviously even scarier. And, you know, I think once it gets out there a bit more that this can be done, I think there's going to probably be some pressure on policymakers to kind of restrict the use of this. It'll probably start with respect to minors. I assume, since there's already like a very firm legal structure in place for that. But I don't know how comfortable people will feel about Zuckerberg, who's always been very, I guess, admirably straightforward about saying, you know, you kind of don't have any privacy anymore, like suck it up. That's always been his kind of motto, is there is no privacy anymore and you should share everything. But to go into like actual face recognition and mining that, I don't know. I think it's going to start feeling kind of itchy for a lot of people.
Well, and I think we'll see some of the first regulation of this coming out of the European Union, because they're way itchier about it than we are in the United States.
It's interesting that the difference between the auto translation and the facial recognition, where, you know, in the auto translation, I think we were surprised that it moved as quickly as it did. Because, you know, it was the power of the algorithms, the power of that, the aggregation of data that did it. And that was surprising. You know, what's making facial recognition, it seems to me, move quicker than we thought, is actually not necessarily the amount of data or the power of the algorithm. It's the complicity of the user. You know, it would be one thing if Facebook had to figure this all out for themselves. But in fact, the users are going in there and telling Facebook who all these people are.
Right.
And so the technological step, once you have everybody in the world, you know, 10 different images of everybody in the world tagged with their, you know, with a box around their face and their name there, you know, the technical challenge becomes relatively trivial, it seems to me. It's the data that the users themselves are offering up that have solved the problem. And I think if people had known full well ahead of time when they first started using Facebook's photo and people tagging service, if they had known ahead of time that it was going to be used not just to help them identify, you know, like, oh, here's my wife in this photo. Oh, is this your wife in that photo? It was going to be able to identify your wife across all of the Facebook photos.
Right. And who's that man she's holding hands with anyway?
Right. Like no matter who took the picture, no matter where she was, it would be able to identify her to other users who may not even be friends with her. That's like a way scarier thing. And that was, I don't think that was made. I think, you know, Dan, you know, people like you who dropped off the network early, you saw that potential. But I don't think most people who, you know, decided to upload all their photos to Facebook and starting, you know, tagging all their friends in those photos, I don't think they realized that's where this was going. And that's what, you know, spooks me out about Facebook.
Well, and Dan will be back on Facebook, because it won't be long before his children are teenagers, and then he'll need to be on Facebook.
No, by that point, everyone will be on app.net.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So
I'm putting my money on Friendster making a comeback.
You know, it's still out there.
I know.
It still exists.
Like a phoenix.
It just won't die. It just won't die. Or it won't stay dead. It's like Generalissimo Francisco Franco, you know, he just won't stay dead. But I will say that for, you know, I share all these concerns. At the same time, as a historian, I'm kind of excited about the application of some of this technology to searching these vast image databases. So if you can, you know, Tom, you do the history of science and technology. If there's a particular model of steam engine that you're interested in, and you can, you know, get a pretty good bead on what it's supposed to look like, then send your algorithm off looking through hundreds of thousands or millions of photographs, looking for that model of steam engine, and then it starts popping up. You know, you could spend your whole lifetime or four lifetimes doing that manually. Now possibly you get, you know, 20 or 30 good hits in a couple of hours. So I think it's, you know, it's not all nefarious. I think there's some, we can put the evil to good use occasionally.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, Tim Sherratt, really talented archivist and software developer in Australia, actually did take some off the rack facial recognition software and applied it, again, if I remember correctly, to a facial a photo database of Chinese Australians, and really made a lot of headway in terms of identification and search and things like that. So I totally agree that, you know, like all technologies, it's sort of the use you put it to. But I think, you know, beyond the awful stuff that Mark Zuckerberg has planned, I think we could think creatively about ways to use it for historical purposes or research purposes in the academy.
Yeah, there's a computer scientist in Zurich who I think may now be working for Google in their Zurich office, and his name escapes me, as all names seem to escape me these days. But I'll link to some of his stuff on the show notes. He did this, what I described about the steam engine. He did that with a motorcycle, and looked back over some database of photographs for examples of that particular motorcycle, and was pretty successful. So certainly I think there's going to be some interesting use for this. You know, there's this famous photograph of Adolf Hitler in a demonstration in Vienna before the First World War, and somebody picked him out of the crowd, you know, the thousands of faces in the crowd, and it's some anti-Semitic demonstration, and this is proof that, you know, Hitler was a fan of anti-Semitism before the First World War, which is not really news, but it was interesting that he was found in that photograph. Well, now an algorithm might do all that searching for us.
Well, and in some cases, I think the algorithms are better at those kinds of catches than sometimes the human eye is. You know, when we have this image of Hitler in our brains, seared into our brains. And it's, you know, it's the 40-year-old Hitler. It's not the 15-year-old Hitler.
Right.
And it's sometimes, I think, hard for us to look at a, you know, look at a crowd, a picture of a crowd where there's a 15-year-old Hitler and to be able to pick him out because, you know, we just have this other image. But a computer algorithm is not looking for, you know, all of the associations that we have, you know, kind of all the baggage we have surrounding images of Hitler. What it's looking for are, you know, facial features, distance between the eyes, those kinds of things. And those are the same in you know, for different age people. So I think there's a real possibility that these algorithms can do some work that even the most dogged researcher looking at every picture, you know, all of those pictures can do. So that I think is it can get us possibly past some of our own visual biases.
You know,
and that's exciting.
For every engineer working on facial recognition technology who's listening to the podcast today, I'm going to link in the show notes to a sample of something from our 1989 project, and it's a manual, a facial recognition manual that the East German border guards used in training, or the staff used in training their guards at Checkpoint Charlie, and it was pointing out which parts areas of the face you can't easily disguise. So you can grow a beard if you're a man. You can put on glasses if you're a woman. You can put on more makeup to darken your skin and that kind of thing. What you can't change is the way that your brow creases right between your eyebrows when you squint. And so they would make people squint and look at the creases in your forehead because you can't change that. So
yeah, so you know, we'll throw this also into the show notes, but I found Tim Sherratt's piece on it's called The Real Face of White Australia, and he used an open source piece of software called OpenCV that detects faces in photographs, and he ran it over the National Library of Australia's collection and pulled out, you know, this incredible collection of about 7,000 photographs of non-white Australians who were suppressed under the White Australia policy. Really just like an amazing example of that. He also shows he did this on an old laptop, like a 3-year-old laptop. And as he's running the software, he had to stick a huge fan right next to it. So he's got a great photograph of his desk as his laptop almost goes into flames as he kind of runs his thing. But still, the fact that he could do that is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded of the fairly recent story of the new photo of Emily Dickinson that has surfaced recently.
Right.
Previously, there was only one known photo of Emily Dickinson. And just through some, you know, some dogged research and analysis and happenstance and, you know, all of the things that we're familiar with as historians, another photo of Emily Dickinson as a teenager has recently turned up and been verified. You know, it could be that is the kind of find, it seems to me, that, you know, running thousands of images through through facial recognition software would be able to turn up without the kind of, you know, all of the work that went into this one thing.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's hope in these new algorithms, and there's, as Dan said, with every bad there's also some good in there. So as digital humanists, we're going to focus on the good, and we're going to stop tagging our friends in Facebook. We're going to you know, stop using those things which can enrich Mark Zuckerberg and other miners of our images, and just try to focus on the good. And speaking of the good, I have to apologize for something that I failed to do at the beginning of our podcast and point out that we're missing someone today, and that is that Amanda French is not with us, one of our Digital Campus regulars. She is enjoying herself elsewhere and is not available online today. So those of you who are wondering, where the heck did Amanda go? She'll be back at the next podcast. And so thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for you.